From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the governor and top legislative leaders meet again, seeking common ground on the state budget. We'll have the latest from Lansing. Plus, trying to undo the governor's veto of $7 million for five tiny school districts in the UP, Mackinac, Drummond, and Beaver Islands.
This would literally force their schools to shut down by the springtime.
The new state budget gives a tiny bump in funding to community colleges. One college president looks longingly at other states.
Well, in states where the funding is so much more significant, they have an appreciable and related benefit of being able to serve their communities in more significant ways.
And a comparison between incarceration and mental health care between Michigan and Norway. What lessons could we learn? Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what can Michigan learn from Norway's prison and mental health systems?
They're able to, I think, keep a lot of people out of jail or prison who might offend if they had an untreated mental health condition.
We'll talk with a Detroit News reporter who traveled to Norway to examine the intersection of criminal justice and mental health in that country. That'll come up later in the hour. But first, call it a political poker game. Call it horse trading. Call it a game of who's going to blink first. All of that is happening in Lansing as the Republicans in the legislature set the stage for a showdown with Governor Whitmer over her 147 line item vetoes. Today, the Democratic governor met with the top leaders from both sides of the aisle, from the state House and Senate. Afterward, Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta caught up with House Speaker Lee Chatfield.
We had a productive conversation with the governor today and look forward to continuing the conversation on Tuesday.
When can we expect to start seeing things move? Obviously, there's some time element to this.
So there was a lot of progress made in the conversation today with the governor, and I look forward to sitting back down with her on Tuesday and continuing those conversations.
Well, let us get the latest from Lansing with Rick Pluta, and also with him from MLive, Emily Lawler. So, Rick, quickly tell us about this meeting today. I mean, how often does this group, the Quadrant, meet?
Well, we should point out first that we thought it was going to be a Quadrant meeting. The Republican and Democratic leaders from the legislature, the majority and the minority leaders. But apparently it was just the governor and the Republican leaders who met and tried to reach some sort of, I guess, detente. And they came out of it, you know, using sort of this neutral language that said there were no blow-ups, but we can't say if there was progress or if there was not.
Yeah, productive conversation is about as neutral as it gets. So here we have, we've talked for months about the budget and then negotiations and then the collapse of said negotiations. Then we went to line item vetoes and now we're on to supplementals. Emily Lawler, remind everyone exactly what a supplemental is.
Yeah, so this would put additional money into the current budget year. There are a couple of versions of this floating around out there, 20-odd bills on each side from the Republicans, and then also a couple of bills from Democrats. So the governor recently referred to these as opening salvos, and, you know, they're setting the stage for potentially a showdown, but potentially just a compromise.
Because what actually has to happen? So, you know, you have your supplemental, restores funding. What has to happen to make that all succeed?
Well, like a regular bill, it goes through the legislature. It would have to get approval from the House, the Senate, and the governor.
So, Rick, since the legislature gave that governor a budget she calls a mess and she whacked out nearly $1 billion from that, how do we describe the positions that she and Republican leaders have taken amidst the fallout from all those line item vetoes?
Well, It appeared entrenched, and a lot of the interest groups, the service providers, the charter schools, the human services providers were not quite in panic mode, but approaching that. And I've actually, because Emily had a chance to grab a few words with the governor today, you should probably fill us in. But
yeah,
it does seem like there may be something of a thaw.
There's a little bit of a timeliness element to this. You know, the governor is really hopeful that these two sides are going to talk on this. Obviously, she did some talking this morning. And, you know, she said she was hopeful that there would be some hustle on this and that they could get something signed as early as next week.
Lots of hope. Rick, break down for us how the Republicans are kind of setting the stage for this showdown with the governor with their supplementals.
Well, there are they could go for a veto override, but that would require supermajorities, and the votes don't seem to be there. So it's one of the options. And what seems to be, if they don't come to some kind of a deal early next week, that they would do something more like just readopt budget bills and then send them to the governor in the versions that they wanted, and then essentially dare her to veto them again and deal with the fallout again.
And we have certainly heard fallout. Emily, as you wrote about today in MLive, and you just mentioned, we've seen some action from Democrats. Democratic Senator Curtis Hertel, you wrote about, has jumped into the supplemental pool. So what is in his batch of proposals, and explain why he's involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So he has the bill that introduces several of Governor Whitmer's priorities that she had included in her budget that didn't come out in the legislature's final product. Things like additional funding for literacy coaches and a little bit of redistribution about how that funding comes about. And then also a skilled trades program that she's mentioned pretty consistently since introducing her program her budget in March. So there's that element. There's some things that the administration characterized as fixes, moving around some money, putting some more money into the Department of Corrections. And then there's actually some overlap with what the Republicans want to see back. I'll use the rural secondary road patrols for some of our law enforcement agencies as an example, is something that there's a Republican bill for, and there's a you can find it in Senator Hertel's supplemental as well.
So, and we should point out that Senator Hertel matters in this discussion because he's the ranking Democrat, the senior Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee. So he's the lead person in the Senate on these things.
So he's riding point on that.
Exactly.
Rick, we have, as you alluded to, fallout. Certainly, we've heard a lot of criticism aimed at both sides, the governor and the GOP legislative leaders, as they each blame the other. One rural school superintendent scolded both sides, saying they're acting like middle schoolers. How sensitive are they to that public outcry and to the heat?
Well, I mean, remember, but there is a critical difference here, which is between the Republicans and Governor Whitmer on this, or the legislature and Governor Whitmer on this. She's the one who actually took out her veto pen and drew the lines through the programs in this budget. And the Republicans said, we sent this to her. She's the one who removed it. And just, in the time between then and now, I've talked to a bunch of people, and I bet a quarter that Emily's had a similar experience where, these organizations, these groups are going, who's on our team?
Yeah, Emily, what are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely there's a veto everywhere to make some group of people mad. So the governor is dealing with that a little bit, and Rick wins his quarter. I have had some of those conversations as well.
What are the time pressures as they work on the budget? I know, Rick, you kind of touched on there's been certainly a sense of alarm. What kind of time pressures are they looking at until groups really have to start making some very tough decisions?
Well, it depends on which program that you're talking about, that and how much money, and which county or which local government you're talking about. Some are sitting on some reserves that could, carry them through on things like road patrols. But, some are, I guess, doing the local government version of living paycheck to paycheck. And so, probably the smaller the county, for example, the sooner they have to deal with the impact.
And I talked to some local counties and townships recently for a story on how the budget vetoes impact rural communities, and fiscal years are sort of all over the place. I talked to someone who's starting in January, someone who's starting in April, but I think there's a little bit of a consensus, at least around the sooner the better, for these local communities trying to gain some certainty and make their own budgeting decisions.
As you both know from working in Lansing and covering the news out of Lansing, politics is so often a horse race. So who's winning? Is it the Republican leaders who were flummoxed last week by the governor's veto pen, or the governor who's been playing defense over her choices? What do you think, Rick?
I don't think in terms of just the raw politics or the horse race, as you put it, I don't think the Republicans feel like they're losing, that, you know, they stood up and basically went nose to nose with the governor. And I think that Republicans at least feel like they've kind of got her boxed into a corner, because she's either got to live with the blowback from these vetoes, or she's going to have to live with it again when Republicans send her, you know, these bills to restore at least some of the line items.
What do you think, Emily?
I'd agree with that assessment. And, you know, I said before that everyone has something to be mad about. So I think that there's a little bit of that at play here. You know, if you're interested in a specific program, say the Autism Navigator, you know, Governor Whitmer looks like the boogeyman a little bit for cutting that one out.
And she supported it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that the Republicans are hearing a lot from, you know, all these little constituencies add up into to a pretty big segment of people that are interested in seeing some of these vetoes reversed.
Rick Pluto, let's talk a little bit of history. Governor John Engler was notorious for being ruthless, even with his own party, to get what he wanted out of the legislature, even if his moves, you know, were seemingly unpopular. So shrewd but effective. Mm-hmm. Governor Granholm labeled a bit of the opposite, maybe kowtowing to her adversaries in negotiations. Where is Governor Whitmer fitting into this picture of executive rule so far, do you think?
Yeah, the Engler style was kind of a, you know, you might feel hurt now, but you'll thank me later. In terms of his approach. And I guess, you know, we've got to do a, you know, it remains to be seen if Governor Whitmer will fall into the same place. But right now, that, you know, there are, in terms of these constituencies that support these different programs, they're on both sides of the aisle. And they're, I mean, you know, you look at services for, you know, some of these services that they affect, you know, Northern Michigan, which has a lot of Republicans. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are people who are angry at the governor all across the state about this, you know, in Metro Detroit, which is also affected by a lot of these line item vetoes. And again, I mean, like, you know, we said before, they're kind of all going, well, who's on our side here?
Yeah, it's we're really watching a learning curve play out with everybody in the state watching. And as you say, people are hurting. Rick Pluta from Lansing and from MLive, Emily Lawler. Thank you so much to both of you today for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thanks
for having
us. Great
being with you and great being on with Emily.
And coming up, community colleges. They got a slight bump in state funding in this year's budget, but is it enough?
When you've got hundreds of thousands of job shortages in Michigan, I think we're at the tipping point where we can help Michigan fill those jobs, but we need to be able to have assistance to be able to accomplish that effectively.
We will talk about the value of our community colleges up next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are jobs to be had in Michigan, but not enough skilled workers to fill them. That's what business leaders and elected officials have been saying for some time now. Community colleges are often cited as an important part of the solution. But the new state budget gave community colleges an average increase of 0.8%, which is below the rate of inflation. Actual increases will vary depending on the school. For instance, Jackson College, it'll only get an extra $104,000. Put that into context, the entire school's annual budget is $48 million. Here with us now is Dr. Daniel Phelan, president and CEO of Jackson College and the past chairman of the board of directors for the American Association of Community Colleges. Welcome, Dr. Phelan. So how useful is that state funding increase?
Well, not as much as I would like it to be. Unfortunately, we see ourselves as institutions that are responsible to help keep America working, and certainly at a time where talent is the number one issue, I think, principally for business and industry and for our country generally. We have a responsibility to respond in a way that is meeting those current and emerging needs. And with this very, very modest increase, while it is an increase, really has little, if any, impact on most of our institutions. I mean, in some ways, this below inflationary adjustment is more of a rounding error than I would say the significant ability to help us really meet these needs of business and industry.
Representative Kim Lozada is the Republican chairwoman of the Senate's Universities and Community Colleges Appropriations Subcommittee. So she was, you know, a big part of this. And in her words, the funding increases for higher ed were not ideal. But she says the budget was realistic based on the resources we have. What does a realistic funding level look like in your mind?
Well, for me, I think minimally, our costs continue to go up as everybody else. You know, the cost of energy, the cost of construction, all of those costs are going up. And to have something less than traditional cost increases associated with inflation is less than ideal. And if we're going to do something more, if we're going to do something innovative as community colleges and really help our state, you know, pull up itself by its bootstraps and fill these jobs, we've got to go above and beyond just a mere inflation increase. So, for example, at Jackson College, we're trying to help businesses by giving them qualified applicants by moving beyond the traditional letter grade that they might get. We're converting our entire curriculum to competency-based education, which is demonstrable skills that students have that employers can see and recognize. And I think we do a better job with job placement that way. I think the employer is able to hire people that have the skills that they want. And I think we become more efficient, but that all takes time, and it takes work and expense. So from my way of thinking, in answer to your question, an inflationary adjustment is just keeping things going. It's a status quo. But if we're going to do something significant, we need to make investments.
So what changes do you think you're going to have to make at Jackson College to deal with getting a hair over $100,000?
Well, at Jackson College, we're also troubled by the fact that our local property tax is rather low. In fact, out of the 28 public community colleges in the state, we have the lowest rate, and the average homeowner in Jackson County pays the college about $45 a year and change. So the only place I can go is tuition, and our board has been pretty focused on making sure we're accessible, so we can't go there very far. So the bottom line is we make the little adjustments we need to in terms of operation, but the significant gains that we'd like to make to respond to helping with the talent, to serve and help organizations fill those skills gaps and deal with the serious talent shortage in our state really becomes challenging if attainable at all.
So could you be looking at having to slice off courses or let teachers go?
No, we have not. We've not gone that far. We tend to be pretty efficient the way it is. We are a pretty lean organization. But unfortunately, we have had to increase our tuition. And that's how between that and being very efficient as an organization, finding courses that really aren't meeting the needs of industry or low enrollment, you know, we're making the choices where we need to make.
What are you hearing from your colleagues at other community colleges around the state?
Well, I think that there's a countervailing effect here. In addition to getting a small adjustment from the state, we're also seeing a significant decline in enrollment. That's happening nationally with most of the nation's community colleges. There are about 1,100 of us in total. And with the exception of some large MSAs and large communities, enrollments are falling. In the state of Michigan, I think the majority of community colleges are seeing declining enrollment. So that's a declining revenue stream for most of our institutions. And so you've got these declining resources, fewer numbers of students, industry and businesses are asking for more help and better ways to attract and retain talent. And it's hitting us in time where, you know, financially, it's incredibly challenging for my colleagues and for me.
What would you say to someone who maintains community college funding is not as important as other items in the budget? I guess I'm asking, what makes community colleges important to Michigan?
Well, I think community colleges have a significant value proposition in that we help America keep working. We're the ones who meet students where they are. And regardless of whatever journey they have been on, we give them the knowledge, skills, and abilities to be successful in the workplace. And when you've got hundreds of thousands of job shortages in Michigan, I think we're at the tipping point where we can help Michigan fill those jobs, but we need to be able to have assistance to be able to accomplish that effectively.
How do we compare when you look around at other states and you've got that perspective as being the chairman of the board for the American Association of Community Colleges? How does Michigan compare to other states in terms of funding community colleges?
Well, that's a great question. There are so many different models as there are states. You have some states where the total amount of state support is significantly higher. So for Jackson College, for example, the state resources represent in total about 26% of our total revenue stream. But in other states, it's 50, 60, even higher percentages than that. So it's really hard to draw a comparison. But I can tell you that where states are doing very well in terms of economic development and overall vibrancy of their economy, community colleges are supported and contributed to in pretty significant ways.
So what are those community colleges able to do that perhaps you can't?
Well, I think they're doing a better job of seeking out those current emerging needs that industry is looking for. They have significant talent operations in terms of job placement and assisting with apprenticeships. They're able to acquire a state of the market, state of the art instructional equipment that relates to what business and industry is using. And for us at Jackson College, you know, we're struggling to write grants. We're using everything we can. We try to make every dollar act like it were two or three. And so we're very creative and very innovative in that regard. But in states where the funding is so much more significant, they have an appreciable and related benefit of being able to serve their communities in more significant ways.
Last spring, Governor Whitmer said she wanted to eventually make community college free in Michigan, and she talked of a proposed program called Michigan Reconnect to offer non-traditional students, the folks over 25, free community college or job training. How much confidence do you have in her ability to eventually make that happen?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure what the eventual outcome can be or will be, but I can tell you that in various cities and in states across this country, there are programs that are designed to lower those costs to students. Free community college is really a misnomer. It's not free at all. There are significant expenses in going to a community college. So if it's just recovering or paying for tuition, that's not free. Free total education because, you know, their students are still paying for books, they're still paying tuition, they're paying for childcare, they're putting gasoline in their car. And we have a number of first-generation students, so, you know, transportation can be iffy at best. They might have a flat tire, they might need a battery replaced. So to say free is really a misstatement of what the truth is. If it is a scholarship for covering tuition, that's one thing, but that's not free.
Dr. Daniel Phelan, President and CEO of Jackson College, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
It's been my pleasure to be with you today.
What would it look like if more American prisons focused on rehabilitation and treating people who have a mental illness? That's the question that led Detroit News reporter Karen Bouffard to Norway to examine the intersection of criminal justice and mental health in that country. The result, a new series of reports from Karen called Healing Justice. Karen Bouffard, welcome. So why Norway?
Oh, my goodness. Norway has really developed quite a reputation as being kind of a gold standard for how to run a good prison, especially at Halden Prison, which is south of Oslo. And they also happen to have a very well-developed mental health system. So they're able to, I think, keep a lot of people out of jail or prison who might offend if they had an untreated mental health condition.
So, Karen, you visited a maximum security prison there, and it's housing dangerous criminals. Tell us, first in appearance, how does it differ from a maximum security prison here in Michigan?
Well, at Halden Prison, there's no barbed wires, there are no bars, there's no watchtowers, and it's located on a very pretty 75-acre site that has trees on it, and it's just very beautiful.
And you write in your report, Healing Justice, that in Norway, the primary purpose of incarceration is to get people back in the community and not punishment. So I'm wondering, what does that rehabilitative approach look like? I mean, what would an inmate from Michigan be astonished to find and experience if he were transplanted to a prison in Norway?
Well, first of all, the guards don't have any guns, and they have relationships with the prisoners. So I think that the atmosphere inside the prison in terms of personal relationships is very different. The prisoners don't appear to be afraid. They have a much more sort of conversational tone with them. The correctional officers play games and eat meals with the prisoners. Also, the inmates have their own rooms with private bathrooms, and they cook their own meals. They're able to buy fresh fruits and vegetables and meat and so forth in the prison store, and they prepare their own meals.
That I'm sure they would be shocked to encounter that if you put a Michigan prisoner into that prison. And you found that just like here in the U.S., a high percentage of inmates in Norway do suffer from a broad range of mental illnesses, but unlike here, their prison stays are likely to be shorter and they're less likely to wind up returning after serving their time. Why is that, Karen?
Well, they just believe that the loss of freedom is the punishment. And so they don't feel a need really to have the conditions of the prisons punish, you know, people who have committed crimes. And the maximum sentence is 21 years, but they can make that longer if the prisoner is considered too dangerous to get out. So, for instance, Anders Breivik, who was the far-right terrorist who killed 77 people in 2011, he's never expected to get out because they do have this mechanism called preventive detention, where after someone has served their maximum crime, they can actually keep them with the approval of a court. But most people serve pretty short sentences, much shorter than in the United States, and there are no life terms.
And I was struck by a quote you had from a prison official in Norway. They are more than their criminal acts. That contrasts very starkly, I think, from the way we in the United States think of, you know, you're going to go do your time and serve your punishment.
Right. And I think that philosophy that America has of sort of punitive time behind bars, it kind of justifies for, you know, many people the idea that prisons aren't very nice places to be. Whereas in Norway, they believe that prisons should be as normal as possible. The punishment is loss of freedom. And life inside the prison should be as normal as possible. And they believe that this prepares prisoners better for when they're released. And they actually serve the last portion of their prison sentence in an open prison where they're able to go to work or school and have visits with family members and return to the prison at night.
And Karen, while they are in prison, are those inmates who are dealing with mental illness, are they getting a good, appropriate amount of mental health care?
Yes, they do get a lot of mental health care. And our prisoners actually in Michigan also receive mental health care. Mm-hmm. But I think that the biggest contributing factor to their lower rate of recidivism and repeat offenders is that it's not just the mental health care that they receive in prison, it's the atmosphere of the prison that's healthier. So a lot of prisoners in Michigan get mental health care, but if they are living in really a lot of fear and living in conditions that aren't very focused on growth, they might not grow in prison. In fact, they might get worse, is what mental health professionals have told me.
Karen, you talked with state lawmakers who say, in essence, you know, we aren't helping anything when people are going to jail for crimes they probably wouldn't have committed if they'd had mental health treatment. Are we seeing signs of change here in Michigan?
There are many signs of change, but most of the signs of change are actually in the judicial system. We're seeing things like treatment courts and diversionary programs where, especially with juvenile offenders, they might do an evaluation and decide that this young person needs mental health treatment, and so they don't even charge that person with a crime as long as they get the mental health treatment that they need. But in terms of changing conditions inside the prisons, there has been a lot less focus on that.
What do you think policymakers and also just Michigan citizens can take from this two-part series you've done called Healing Justice? What can we take from this?
Well, North Dakota and Oregon have both sent delegations to Norway and studied their prison system and are actually starting to adapt some of the Norwegian methods in the way that they run their prison. I don't think it's going to happen that we're going to come up with the money to build new prisons that look like Halden Prison. But what they're doing in North Dakota, for instance, is just taking small steps. Like they've started trying to get their guards to communicate more with inmates, and they've gotten rid of some of their minor punishments for things that are not allowed in jail or prison that, you know, might not be such a big deal if they were outside of prison. So they're just taking small steps. And I think if our corrections officials could just start taking some small steps, it could have some impact on the general direction that our prison system is headed in.
Karen Bouffard, her two-part series, Healing Justice, can be found in the Detroit News. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, a new plan out of Wayne County attempts to help homeowners on the brink of tax foreclosure stay in their homes.
Whatever revenue we derived from putting people out of their homes, it doesn't make any sense compared to keeping more homeowners and keeping more people more stable in their homes.
We'll talk about that after the break. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new idea to help homeowners in Detroit and Wayne County who are struggling to pay off delinquent property taxes is making its way to Lansing. This proposal is called Pay As You Stay, and it was announced Wednesday by Wayne County Executive Warren Evans and Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan. We have more now from Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick.
People who qualify for a city's low-income property tax exemption would be eligible. Back taxes would be capped at the amount owed or 10% of a home's taxable value, whichever is less. Interest and fees would be waived. Homeowners would then have 3 years to pay off the taxes at 0% interest. Linda Smith says the program would be a godsend for many. She works with the Detroit nonprofit USNAP Back.
We all know it's very hard to pay your bills when you're trying to play catch up, especially when you've gotten behind.
Lansing would need to sign off on the plan.
And with us now is Wayne County Executive Warren Evans. So good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So tell us, first of all, why does Lansing need to sign off on this?
Well, you know, to make the structural changes in the ability to get rid of the penalties, fees, and interest, I'm sorry. That would take some intervention because it's changed from the current statutes that govern this.
And have you talked with other counties about whether this would be a helpful thing to them as well, or is this a Wayne County-specific problem?
No, in my understanding, the treasurers, you know, talking to each other. I haven't directly talked to the treasurers, but the sense is from those who have been involved with that, yeah, there are a number of treasurers that see value in this and think it will be good, and there are some others that probably are opposed, or at least at this point don't know enough about it to be in agreement. But, you know, there's certainly ways to do that, and, you know, one of them is to, you know, make it applicable to counties above a certain population or in a certain geographic area. It doesn't have to be a wholesale thing for the entire state, and we certainly don't want to force anything on people that don't want it. But it's certainly something that would be beneficial here.
So this plan would help people going forward. How about people who've racked up a considerable debt and interest already?
Well, that's really what this does. It will take people who are currently in here. A lot of people have. We probably have over 30,000 people on payment plans, so they have a current payment plan. But that payment plan includes interest, fees, and penalties. And what we would be doing is to be able to remove at least the interest, fees, and penalties, and they would be paying on the unpaid actual property tax. And so, you know, an example of someone who, you know, was paying $50 a month in addition to trying to keep current on their taxes, $50 a month in previous penalties, interest, and fees might now be at $10 or $20 a month. So there's a significant
amount of money that people would be able to keep in their pockets. And obviously people in financial distress, every little bit helps. And, you know, it would certainly give them more income to help them conduct their lives.
Yeah, certainly. We just heard Linda Smith from USNAP Act say it is very hard to pay your bills when you're trying to play catch up. Do you think this plan goes far enough?
I think it's a big step in the right direction, quite frankly. I was a proponent for getting rid of the back taxes, period, if you qualified for the tax exemption. But, you know, you have to get a consensus of people to try to make something happen, and it appears that the closest we could get to that, quite frankly, was this. And I don't see it as window dressing. I mean, I see it as substantive. I mean, we could have done more. I would have liked to have seen more. But having said that, people will get real relief from this. And, you know, clearly it's the county that is going to lose the funds anyway. So, I mean, I have far more skin in the game than the rest. But it is, to me, not even arguable that whatever revenue we derived from putting people out of their homes, it doesn't make any sense compared to keeping more homeowners and keeping more people more stable in their homes. So, I'm not going to miss the revenue when compared to having more stable neighborhoods and more people being able to avoid foreclosure with their homes.
But it's pretty clear that you would have liked to have seen those back taxes and really go retroactive and give people a clean slate.
I would have, yes.
Do you see that being able to, is this kind of incremental? You'll take this right now, you've got this beachhead established, but then you'd like to pursue this further?
I mean, I would like to see that. I don't know that there's going to be, again, that's an issue that would be dealt with a little differently. Quite frankly, maybe not even statutorily. I'll always say we could do it, but, you know, you're always going to find lawyers who don't, and so... This is, I mean, whether it's the first step or this is where we wind up, it will give significant relief to an awful lot of people.
Mr. Evans, we've known this has been a problem that has been brewing for years, and we know thousands of people have lost their homes. Why has it taken until now to come up with a plan that can help low-income homeowners?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't know that I have any real answer for you other than it's something like many things that involve a city, involves counties, involves, the state legislature in many ways, and just the ability to come together on sound footing to be able to make something happen in government is often very, very difficult and very, very frustrating, quite frankly. You know, my staff spent the last year creating a task force and working through recommendations that would get us some solution to the problem. And I dare say that if it wasn't for the work of that group, this never would have materialized. I think, quite frankly, this materialized as as something that was more acceptable to some of the players than the full issue, elimination that I was talking about. And so,
let's talk about some of those players. So what are the political sticking points about this issue in Lansing with the Republicans who control the legislature? I mean, what have you been hearing from, in particular, Senate Majority Leader Shirky and House Speaker Chatfield?
Haven't really heard anything from them yet, and that's okay. I mean, we just had the press conference the other day, yesterday, announcing what we're doing here. And so I will certainly spend my time in Lansing, as I would expect that the mayor of the city of Detroit will, and the treasurer, along with our delegation, to see what we can carve out here. And I mean, it's plausible to me that it can be done because it doesn't have to have statewide effect. Depending on how it's drafted, if it's easy to draft something to cover Wayne County. You do it based on population. There's nobody else close. So it doesn't have to have a negative effect on people who would think it was negative. I mean, I don't see a negative effect at all, frankly.
How about locally? Are you and Mayor Duggan and Treasurer Sabree all on the same page about what should be done?
Well, I hear your question, and as it relates to this, yes, because we've all come to
sure.
come to terms with this as the initiative. I mean, I already said I would have liked sure. to have more, but that ship has sailed.
That ship has sailed. Does political infighting or political disagreement, does it prevent real solutions from happening for real people?
Everywhere, every day, just a reality. I mean, and I think, quite frankly, down here we do far better than many places. But there are different priorities, different issues, and this is one that whatever the political issues are that players have here, if you drill down to the core of it, the thing that makes us all comfortable is it will give real relief, not window dressing relief, to an awful lot of people, keep an awful lot of people in their homes. And yes, we could talk all day about, could we do more? But let's just do this first and give people that real relief. And, we can always crunch the data as that occurs. And if there's a logical argument for going further, then at least we have something more supportive to make that argument.
So what happens next? When could we expect to see this relief happening for these homeowners who owe the taxes?
That's just going to be up to the legislature. And I'd hate to venture a guess. All I can say is we're not going to take any time off lobbying our state senators and reps and dealing with the issue in Lansing. So I really can't give you a timeline just because I can't speak for another branch of government, but I can certainly say we're not going to let any grass grow under our feet trying to move it forward.
Wayne County Executive Warren Evans on the new Pay As You Stay plan. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The challenges of running a tiny, remote school district are a lot different than an urban or suburban district. You have a small number of students coming from great distances, so if money's tight, consolidating with a neighboring district isn't much of an option. 5 isolated school districts, 2 in the UP, and districts on Mackinac, Beaver, and Drummond Islands rely on state funding from the $7 million isolated school fund. But that fund was zeroed out by Governor Whitmer in her flurry of 147 line item vetoes, and the shockwaves were immediate. And now State Representative Sarah Cambensi is hoping to restore that funding. The Democrat from Marquette is here with us now. Representative, what did you hear from superintendents from these isolated districts?
To be perfectly honest, the word they used was devastating. This would literally force their schools to shut down by the springtime. And knowing that there would be 25% cut in their funding to those Paradise schools, which I have one of, they were worried their teachers were going to jump ship now. So they're in panic mode. I look at the other 9 districts on that list that receive funding out of 22D, and they're going to have to make severe cuts to their busing, some of their classroom aid. So the cuts were real, and a lot of times people think the rural areas are all red or Republican, but I'm up there kind of in the middle of it, and these cuts certainly hurt me just as much as my colleagues on the other side.
And just to help people understand life in these very, very tiny remote districts. So let's say for the 26 students in the Burt Township District there in Grand Marais, what would it mean if their school had to close? Where is it they would go?
When we were there last Friday, we heard parents say that they would have to move, so quit their jobs, move out of those small communities, put their students in other districts that are an hour, some even longer, and further away. So their main concern was, if this school closes, I don't want my son or daughter to sit on a bus for an hour and a half in the morning and then again at night. And when you look at the square miles that they bus, I mean, they're busing kids, in an 800 square mile radius daily on some of these districts.
So the ripple effects spread out from the school building into communities possibly losing families.
Yes. And that's why, when we went to Burt Township, the township supervisor came, school board members came. We even had a small business owner come and kind of tell us, what this impact is on them. And when you hear that, I can tell you that it resonated with me. It resonated, with my Republican senators that were also visiting the district. that we have to get down here and get back to work and really work together on some of this stuff.
So you are a Democrat introducing a supplemental bill to restore funding that was cut by Governor Whitmer. Is it accurate to say you're not completely on board with her approach to these budget negotiations?
You know, I think what happened was is the severity of this hit us, you know, last week to where we started working on a supplemental long before we knew what the Republicans were doing, long before we knew what the governor was doing. And so, you know, when my colleagues who are Republicans went to pull their bill package, they could only get 23 out of the 24 bills because I had already put one in. And so that's where the conversation started with allowing me to still put that bill in and trying to communicate with the governor on exactly how drastic this cut was and why I need to do what I need to do.
So you jumped right in before the Republicans even had a chance to put a bill in to restore this isolated district money.
I did.
What would you like to see the governor have done differently?
You know, I think it's hard. You know, for the last 8 years, we've had all one party controlling government down here in Lansing. So I think there are some growing pains on both sides just to kind of see how the power is going to play out and even how to negotiate. I mean, I think over 8 years, you forget, you know, certainly how to negotiate and that for some of my Republican colleagues that they actually have to come to the table and negotiate now that the governor does have veto power. And I think we're working through that. It's painful. We're in the public eye. But I can tell you that every day, every hour down here, we're getting closer to getting the budget together. It's not, you know, a knockdown, drag-out fight. We actually are working together, and I think we'll get there.
We've seen throughout this process both the governor and the Republican legislative leaders blaming each other, with each saying the other side is using this as a political football. How do you see this?
You know, I honestly see it right where my residents and constituents do. I'm sick of it. Both sides are doing it. And I think that's why I came down last week and said, I got to do something. This is what my constituents want. I work for them. I don't want to be responsible for sitting by and watching both sides duke it out. And that's why I jumped on that bill and said, I'm starting with this one. And, you know, there were three others I was going to start working on. But, you know, luckily, both sides are at the table right now. And I do think we can stop the bomb throwing from each side and actually come together and say, we did it. We solved the problems. We put that funding back in.
And have you had a chance to talk with either the governor or House Speaker Chatfield about the situation specifically with the isolated schools?
You know, it's mostly her staff, people that work under her. We've worked closely. You know, certainly they understand that a lot of the programs that were cut in rural areas also affect me. You know, I think that's why Speaker Chatfield, when he found out I had that bill, just said, you know what, we're going to let you have that one. I understand you're trying to fight for the same things we are. So both sides understand that. And again, I just think we're working through, you know, the relationships and what does it mean to actually come to the table and compromise on both sides and what is best for the people. Because at the end of the day, my dad always told me, you know, when you take these jobs as elected officials, you take a step down. And you work for everyone above you, and that's the people who put you there. Whether they voted for you or not, that's who you work for. And I think we're getting to that point, but I think what's played out in the public eye is that we're working through, you know, our growing pains.
We are talking about five districts serving 319 kids, and there is a discrepancy between the per pupil allotment that these students are getting when you compare to other districts that are also struggling. How do you answer anyone who questions, is this really fair?
You know, at least in the UP, I haven't had anyone question that. I think if a nearby school district were to pick up those students, they would have the same funding challenges. They would be spending more to go out and bus and pick those students up. So I think there's an understanding, at least in the UP, that this is the best way to handle those isolated districts that might have a small year-round population, but in the summer with tourism, those towns are blossoming and full of people. Down here, my colleagues might not understand it as well, but I think as we go through, you know, line items and talk about the school aid fund and other more expensive needs for some of our students, you know, that will be my time to kind of stand up and give my side of the story on why this funding is critical for my district.
Marquette Democratic Representative Sarah Cambensi of the 109th District, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Stateside, why does the Michigan Department of Transportation build roads with concrete in some places and asphalt in others? How can the roads last longer? We'll look at what's the best bang for the buck for Michigan roads on the next Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That's today's program. Thank you so very much for listening.